The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
It has been proclaimed by the White House that it is now Irish. But this may bode well for the White House visit on Patrick's Day. We will get to that. We'll also get to stories about the tagging of violent offenders. With me is Aisling O'Rourke, who is podcaster and media lecturer, and Jack Horgan-Jones, political correspondent with the Irish Times. And it is Jack Horgan-Jones who is on the front of that paper today. Officials cast doubt on housing data before the headline, or before the election, is the headline on his story. Now, Jack, this is... We were all told in the run-up to the election and during the campaign that 40,000 houses had been, would be delivered by the end of 2024. And then we discover that was an entirely fictitious number and a ball of smoke. What your analysis is telling us is that that was sort of known at the time.
Well, yeah. So the basis for the story was I went off and put in a Freedom of Information request asking for any kind of analysis, any internal documents, any thinking that the department had done around this 40,000 figure. And really, it doesn't seem that there was any departmental numbers which suggested 40,000 was going to be the outturn. In fact, the private analysis consisted of gathering together a bunch of forecasts that were done by private sector actors. And some of them did say 40,000, in fairness. But there was also one in particular done by an outfit called BNP Paribas. Most people will know that name. And they have a very good track record, apparently, in predicting the outturn in housing. And this is something that the officials said all the way back in August in a note to the minister. They said, it looks like we probably will hit the targets. We know they didn't in the end, but they believe they would at the time. But have a look at BNP Paribas. They have a good track record. And going on their numbers, their projection was between 30 and 33,000. It's going to be challenging to hit the numbers overall. So the question, I suppose, is
which
how
is
you get
the target by 25%. That's a fair miss.
The target itself was 33,250.
But the declared political ambition,
the belief that Dara Brian had asserted and put down in writing in a letter to the coalition leaders, which then formed the basis for the campaign trail, claimed that they were going to hit in and around 40,000, was based on overly sunny projections only by some operators within the market, nothing from within the department. And what's interesting in the FOI docs, the documents as well, is that at no point do the officials say, yeah, look, these optimistic ones, we think they're the right ones. There's nothing that's kind of pushing him towards that 40,000 figure. And there is this clear note of caution. And as the year goes on, you can see as well, they're becoming a little bit more concerned, saying, look, there's a lot of uncertainty here. We'll probably hit the target, but there is a bit of uncertainty. And then back in August, they are pointing to this one, which proved to be correct. And as they said at the time, had a track record in being correct. So I suppose the question is for Dara Brian, why did you take the very most optimistic ones when there was equal, if not more, grounds to believe that you were about to hit some difficulty as it transpired the case was going to be?
In political terms, whatever cliche we wish to apply, water under bridge, spilt milk, stable doors, given that he is now out of that role and the election is over, will this have any impact on anybody?
Well, I think certainly the calculus at the time could well have been, it won't be until after the election before we can possibly be proved wrong on this, and maybe nobody will remember. But I don't think that's panning out, to be honest. This 40,000 figure, I think, has been lodged in the public consciousness in a way that they may not have anticipated. People have latched onto it as evidence not only of the failure to hit both the political aspiration target of 40,000 and the actual target of 33,250, but a feeling, and certainly the political charge has been levelled, of misleading the electorate. So I think it's a thing for people now, and I think people remember, and I think that that is evidenced by the fact that the opposition feel it in their waters as well. They raise this all the time, and there was a serendipity as well to the fact that on the day that Micheál Martin was eventually elected Taoiseach after a short delay, those figures from the CSO came out, which showed there was only 30,330 homes built last year, missing both those targets.
Now, am I naive in this? But I would have thought if you are in the midst of a national housing crisis, which you have been in for nigh on half a decade at this point, that the best source of information on the progress to meet your targets should come from within some arm of government. Should the best sources of data not be state, rather than looking externally to analysis done by banks?
That is a really good point. And that's why I put in the request in the first place, because I thought they must have some kind of brains trust in there that is crunching all these numbers or producing their own numbers. But no, it looks like their best effort was to kind of synthesize and provide a commentary on the private sector analysis. Now, not to get too deep in the weeds, but some of the records that weren't released to me under Freedom of Information records under the request do suggest that they're trying to think of some kind of statistical model that would be better at projecting this going forward. So maybe they will have one in the future. But as of now, it seems to be more just kind of looking at the published analyses done by market operators.
Which I think plays some extent out into the sense of there is no sign in anything emerging that there is the silver bullet to solve this housing crisis, despite the fact of it being a housing crisis that had gone on there for years.
Exactly. And like one of the really frightening things now is that we are once again facing a generation of young people in their 18 and up who are fundamentally convinced that their future lies abroad. And it's just, it's cyclical, it's frustrating. And people, I think, have latched on to that 40,000 figure because it affects every single one of us. Like, there was a report released during the week from the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council and the Climate Change Advisory Council. A very stark report about the financial impact of not tackling climate change. And the figure, the cost there, whether we do something about it or we don't, is 27 billion euro. In the main, people are not talking about it because 27 billion euro is so big, it's not tangible to us. It's hard to grasp. So we're doing the ostrich thing and putting our head in the sand on it. Whereas on housing, every single one of us knows someone affected by this. So it's not going away and people are feeling really hopeless on it. And you know, there doesn't seem to be an understanding from government in the government comms that actually young people, people affected by this, we need to see tangible action and a bit of hope here.
And why didn't that materialise in the vote pattern of the electorate then? How did the electorate say, we are this aggrieved by this problem, but we'll also happily return the government who produced this problem?
Because the opposition, in my humble opinion, spent a lot of time criticising what the government was doing and not enough time on convincing the electorate that they had a plan to fix it.
Oh, I can hear Eoin O'Brien seething from here. He will point to his 106-page document of detailed analysis of precisely how Sinn Féin would fix it.
Yes, exactly. A 106-page document. Most citizens don't have the time, Anton, to sit down and read that. It's about the communications exercise that they failed to engage in actually really simplifying and explaining it clearly. Do you know what? If you elect us, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. And at the end of the day, and what no one is talking about is the construction problem here is down to the fact that after the Celtic Tiger crash, an awful lot of people either chose to never chance going into a trade because that's not a stable career, or they left and they haven't come back. And we're very short in physical hands to build the houses that we need.
I remember years ago, Jack, reading watching a thing from, I think it was Milton Friedman, who said, he was talking about inflation. He said, if you want to cure inflation, what you do is you index link every congressional and Senate salary to the rate of inflation and you make it that they don't get paid unless it's zero. You'll fix it overnight. What, you're hanging around the Oireachtas a fair bit. To what extent do you think that the elected members, particularly governmental elect, see this as a genuine crisis that they care deeply about?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that one cannot but live in Ireland in 2025 and grasp on some level the extent of the crisis. And I think that that is because it's now kind of cross-generational.
Yeah, but there's crisis like Troika at the door, create NAMA, do big things, stay up all night, fix it. And there's crisis like climate change that is there and big, but sort of, it's somebody else's problem.
And the question is, where does it lie on that kind of spectrum?
Who's losing sleep in government over this?
Well, I think they all are now, although they didn't get as chastening an outcome in the election as they may have done, as you point out, for a whole variety of reasons. But I think that now, given the kind of the intent that they seem to be carrying towards the problem, saying that, you know, unpopular decisions need to be taken. But I suppose the issue is housing. It's a bit like the way we used to think about health a little while ago. Like, it's a big, chronic, but ultimately hugely complex problem. There's no lever you can pull that solves the housing crisis. And even if it cost 27 billion euros to pull that lever, I suspect they'd do it. There's too many multifaceted, overlapping parts of this issue. It's a wicked problem. And it's also one of those things where you might have a policy intervention. So the policy instrument may be launched, budget day, whatever. It may be years before you really have a proper assessment of the efficacy of that intervention. Meanwhile, the issue continues to snowball and get bigger. I mean, it's very easy to kind of truncate it into easy sound bites like it's all about supply, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the problem is that, like, nothing really seems to be fundamentally addressing this. And to bring it back to where we started, the numbers, the outturn, the big fear in government, I think, is that the 2024 number of just north of 30,000 is not a blip. Actually, the blips may have been 22 and 23, which showed an increase, a post-COVID increase. If this is the new trend, then honestly, I think that is a coalition threatener. If they start
and
racking
waiting up, the rest of our lives to finally get the numbers back to where they need to be then, by that measure.
Exactly, yeah. If they start racking up bad numbers, quarter in, quarter out, year in, year out, that becomes a real problem for them, a really fundamental, systemic, existential problem for the coalition, I think.
One wonders if Micheál Martin is looking ahead to the end of his tenure in Taoiseach, thinking that would be a nice mark to show a reversal in
He already claimed during the term of the last government that the government of the state had turned a corner on housing on the basis of these numbers. No, it hadn't.
The other thing that the parties, particularly Fianna Fáil, had gone heavily on in the run-up to the last election was law and order. Front page of the Irish Daily Mail today reporting, this is the Minister Jim O'Callaghan pledging, we will tag offenders out on bail. O'Callaghan's promises over 40,000 crimes committed last year involved suspects on bail. Hard to see this being an unpopular move, Aisling.
Absolutely. It sounds fantastic. Like, you know, if you're out on bail for a serious crime, of course you'd be tagged. Of course, you know, why wouldn't we be doing this? A, it costs money, but actually it costs people hours. So like, if you're going to tag alleged criminals or people with a history of crime and previous convictions, you're going to need someone either in the probation service or the court service or the Gardaí to have responsibility of monitoring these tags, to be able to go back over the data. And like, one of the wonderful things with the advent of AI in healthcare is that patients now have the ability to phone up their medical team and say, listen, my pacemaker, I don't feel well. Can you check in there in the pacemaker and see how I'm doing? And when you make the phone call and they have the time to look, they look and they'll have that conversation. But speak to anybody in the medical professional, they'll say they don't really have the time to make full use of the data that's available in order for patients to have a benefit here. And with the tagging, it's going to need a significant increase in man hours, or people hours, I should say, in actually being able to track this data. Like Gardaí investigations, even like with the body cams now, all of that's going to take extra resources.
But surely if that number is right, if it's 40,000 crimes committed involving suspects who are out on bail, surely it could be as simple as, well, okay, that house was robbed. Let's look at our trackers and see, did anybody wearing a tracker happen to be in it when they shouldn't have been? Yes, there was. Go arrest them.
Absolutely. But I suspect it's not as simple as that. My knowledge, hands up, of tagging devices is based entirely on Hollywood. I have no...
Long may it stay that way, Aisling. Exactly. Fingers crossed.
But like, you know, it does look, it all sounds, and I would like, according to the article in the Daily Mail, these tagging devices are going to be focused on violent and serious crime. I would argue that if you have somebody coming before the courts for their 30th offence, or like, I don't care how small the offences are, like, there, maybe it's a way of reducing that down. But it just, and I'm sorry to be so practical about it, but it's actually like, how is this actually going to work at the end of the day? Someone's going to need to have the job of monitoring all these devices. Someone's going to have the job of making sure that, well, if you have a tag placed on you, that you haven't figured out a way of getting it off you and perhaps have just left it at home when you're off out doing something you shouldn't be doing.
It is good populist stuff as a first gambit for the new Justice Minister, though, isn't it?
Well, it's a good headline, right? And it's in response to these pretty eye-popping figures that Matt Carthy, the Sinn Féin justice spokesman, dug out during the week. You referenced them there. 114,000 incidents over the past 3 years where crimes were committed in cases where suspects were on bail. So that's just over 40,000 last year alone. I mean, that's an extraordinary number. The question I would have, I suppose, is how many of those would not have been committed had, you know, a certain percentage of these people had electronic tags on? I'm not sure there's a clear and straightforward answer to that. Maybe, as you suggest, it might make detection a little bit easier if you had a kind of real-time map of where everyone who is on bail is in the country, and you could match it up against where offences have been committed. Maybe not. But also, the fact that these people have been detained suggests that traditional policing interventions is getting them anyway. So maybe if you know your location is a condition of your bail, don't go into X or Y area, then maybe that's intervention. That's an effective intervention. Maybe there's a behavioural one as well. You're just less likely to commit a crime if you have this reminder of your status of being on bail.
Well, two inferences out of that. One being, if you're right in saying that conventional policing is catching the 40,000, it raises the question as to whether or not maybe that number is much greater when you count the ones that aren't caught. Meaning maybe there are many more offences being committed by people on bail and the current policing isn't.
Maybe so. I mean, it strikes me that, you know, there's a greater, more profound kind of structural issue at play here than one that can be simply tackled by the application of a beeping box to an ankle, you know, and I think that if you look at something like, you know, the amount of time it takes for petty crimes and so on to actually make their way through the criminal justice system, like, you know, if someone's looking at a 2 or 3 year wait, they're not going to be held on remand for 2 or 3 years. They're going to be put on bail. So if you want to actually address this issue and perhaps address the issue of people being given bail who otherwise should not be because they are at a risk of reoffending, well, then maybe you need to resource the court system better so people actually move through that process.
And the prison system, likewise, because we're creaking at the seams in terms of where to put people.
Now, I'm not sure to what extent judges would be minded of that, but it is a fact that I think we're over capacity in nearly every prison in the state, and quite drastically in some instances.
Like you see in various court cases, you know, so-and-so has been released on bail pending a court case, but that so-and-so has had previous convictions, and you do wonder, like, should we take a closer look at who is being granted bail? Because bail is a privilege. And, like, should courts be able to place greater emphasis on previous convictions in deciding whether or not someone can be afforded bail?
Texts say, Anton, surely tracking devices will cut out a lot of investigation hours. A good place to start. Less analysis, paralysis. I suppose that is a point as well. It probably foreshortens some of the existing guard the time that's being put into prosecution.
Quite possibly. Look, I'm not saying that this is necessarily a bad idea. I'm just saying that, you know, it's probably a more complex problem than can be solved, strictly speaking, than just a technological solution.
Interesting to see the amount of people who are still, unsurprisingly, passionate about the housing problem. I'm paying €700 a month. My neighbour is paying €1,300 for a cost rental from an approved housing body. We both can definitely afford mortgages for where we want to be, but the banks say no. The government needs to get in the business of realistic mortgage approval for people like us. If you can't achieve a mortgage from the bank, the government should supply it. I have been on the council waiting list for 21 years. I could be nearing the end of a mortgage now if the government, past and present, lived in the real world. The housing minister needs to make the rules and regulations uniform between county councils. 53106, if you want to get in touch, or 087 1400 106 on WhatsApp. Just at the point where we thought the America as a body politic, as represented by the new administration, had turned against us and would be making all of our multinationals head back with the profits on which we so depend. Turns out they still love us. It has been declared Irish-American month, Aisling. This is, I assume, good news.
Okay, well, first things first, as I understand it, in March, traditionally in America in March, it's Black History Month. So that's an interesting development in recent days. I'd watched the video, actually, of Trump the other day before even you. We'd be discussing it this morning when he was signing this proclamation. And he, I think, really answered the question as to why this and why now. Irish Americans voted for Trump in massive numbers, and he's trying to keep them happy by acknowledging them. He said it himself. It's, look, there is a sting in the tail in the official proclamation around the tariffs and trade and all of that between our two countries. But it is, I don't think it's about keeping us over here particularly content. It's about doing something to keep those who are voting for him happy and acknowledging.
But it does, it would therefore, I would have thought, suggest that if he is trying to keep the Irish American electorate happy, he is somewhat less likely to poke our Taoiseach in the eye while he has him in the Oval Office than he might have been. No?
We can hope. Optimistic?
I think that's a reasonable assessment of, you know, his emotional state when he comes to think about about Ireland and the Irish people, and you know, his instinct electorally arising from that emotional state. He seems to be broadly speaking well disposed.
What about Marco Rubio bringing up the trade imbalance with or not, depending on which side you believe?
We'll get to that, because Aisling referenced the sting in the tail, and when you actually look at the proclamation that he signed, that language around trade imbalance is actually there as well. So it's in there. It's in the third or fourth paragraph.
Now, I have it here.
It references correct trade imbalances with the European Union as opposed to Ireland. But the fact that that language
and
is
used again...
And it goes
on, our historic relationship with Ireland presents an opportunity to advance fairer trade policies and stronger...
Yeah, so there's a little bit of a which side are you on there kind of thing. You know, are you with us, or are you with your pals in Europe? So look, this is real commentator's curse thing, but I suspect that given the kind of bonhomie and pageantry around the Shamrock ceremony and the fact that Trump doesn't seem to be necessarily emotionally badly disposed to Irishness favours us going in there. But the fact is, the guy is so erratic and so volatile that a lot will depend on his mood and the last piece of paper or the last thing that someone said to him about Ireland before he goes into that meeting, or what question reaches his ears from the gaggle of reporters in the Oval Office at the time. So that's the jeopardy, and that's the uncertainty and the risk that Micheál Martin is facing going
in there. It does show, though, that the Irish diaspora electorate still has a heft, because one of the things that a lot of commentators would have said in run-up to the last election was that thing of the influence of the Irish as in a voting bloc in America had waned. This would suggest it hasn't totally.
I think it probably has.
So why is he pandering?
I think what he's saying there, look, I think that Irish America doesn't operate as a political bloc in the way that it might have done in the days of Tammany Hall, you know, and it certainly is not. I think what he's instinctively correct on is that it's not a democratic leaning bloc insofar as it exists anymore at all. And because of their demographic and their racial profile and everything, they're probably more likely to vote Republican than they would have previously. So given an opportunity to kind of reach into a part of someone's, you know, identity, he's gonna do that and say, you know, I love Irish America. But I think that people Irish America doesn't move as one block, as I said, and people don't necessarily form their voting intent because they're Irish American anymore. I think there's other factors that are overriding, but it doesn't mean they totally forget it either. So it's worth his while kind of reminding people, and also just it's the braggadocio as well. You know, he'll always point out that certain cohorts vote for him in huge numbers. You know, according to him, every cohort votes for him in huge numbers.
Best president ever, let's never forget. While we're staying across the water, there's more details now emerging, Aisling, on the passing of Gene Hackman and his wife Betsy, who died, it turns out now, a week apart from each other.
And so as we understand it, Betsy died of hantavirus pulmonary syndrome, which, I apologise if you're eating your breakfast, is an infectious disease that you can get from rodent droppings. And, well, they have dogs in the house, and anybody knows if you have animals, it's easy to pick up these things because dogs pick up bits when they're
out. But this virus has a sort of a 40% fatality rate.
Yes, as we understand it, she was last seen on the 11th of February. So I think last night when the push notifications started coming out, we were wondering why did they know that she died on the 11th and then Gene Hackman died on the 18th. So as I understand it now from reading it this morning, they collected one of the dogs from the vets on the 9th of February. So the reason that one of the dogs was in the crate was because it had undergone a procedure, and obviously if they've had surgery, you have to keep them confined. She was last seen on the 11th of February, so it seems to be, reading between the lines, that's where that date has come from, and that she was at an advanced stage of
significant illness. It seems, by virtue of Alzheimer's, may not have known the situation that he was in, nor was able to contact anybody.
He had advanced Alzheimer's, but he also had an advanced cardiac disease as well. So, and obviously, like, none of us really know, but you would assume he was on medication for that. If she's his sole caregiver, giving him his medication, and then she dies 7 days previously, you know, there's nobody to care for him there. And look, in all honesty, I'd like to think he didn't know what had happened. But we don't know. And depending on the Alzheimer's, he may have had moments of lucidity.
It's desperately sad, though, to think that at 95 years of age, there'd be a week where nobody would contact you.
We were talking about this.
Isn't it? It is,
It is desperately sad. And And I know a culture in different countries is quite different. I'm the person, I'm the annoying daughter that when I get bored when I'm driving on hands-free, of course, you know, I phone the parent to basically check she's still alive. Yeah, it is. It is very sad. And I suppose I was surprised as well, and maybe this is me glamorising Hollywood, but I kind of was surprised they didn't have any home help given the advanced state of his condition, because having had people in my family with different types of dementia and Alzheimer's, I know what hard work it is, and it's not a solo thing to care for somebody with that particular condition.
So but even if you don't have a significant medical ailment, there are very few people at 95 years of age who couldn't do with a bit of a dig out in some way at some point.
Yeah, and like, it's just, it's very surprising that there was nobody going in, or that they didn't have a housekeeper. Like, neither were particularly young individuals and were, you know, particularly wealthy. So the whole thing is it's just very sad and a little bit strange, and I don't think we're going to get the full picture for some time to come.
We will go to a slightly positive note, because we were discussing housing earlier on, and it is rare that you get an upbeat text in relation to housing, but we got one. We managed to buy a house through Rebuilding Ireland despite the challenge of being a one income family with four children. Previously, we were at the mercy of a greedy landlord who wouldn't fix things that were broken in the house. Now we have the security of our own roof over our heads and scope to make a home of our own. You don't hear many positive stories rehousing, but in fairness, in our case, a government initiative meant we were able to move our family into a better situation, and we are very grateful for it. And you can hear the clamouring of the thousands who are in the position you were in, saying they would like to join you in that same end result. 53106 if you want to get in touch, or 087 1400 106 on WhatsApp. A big thank you to Jack Horgan-Jones, political correspondent with the Irish Times, and Aisling O'Rourke, podcaster and media lecturer.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.